As kids head back to school, experts say sleep should be part of the routine. CDC data shows about 3 out of 4 high school students don't get the recommended 8 hours on a typical school night. Teens need 8 to 10 hours, so experts recommend gradually shifting bedtimes earlier before school starts. If you are in Stamford, today is the first day of school. Many other districts starting over the next couple of days and, of course, next week. So if you are lucky enough to start changing the routine, I should say, that's great. However, if you're like everyone else who's now in the thick of it, how do we adjust with our sleeping schedules, not just the kids, but even the adults? Joining us now is Dr. Linnell Schneeberg, who is the Yale Medicine sleep psychologist and associate professor at Yale School of Medicine. Doc, thank you so much for giving us the time. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm very glad to have you on. I actually love talking about sleep, mostly because I always worry that I am shaving years off of my life doing this job. While I love this job very much, that 3 a.m. alarm never gets comfortable. So I would love to focus on the rise time. Because I think it's important, obviously, as we talk about back to school, how do we reset kids' sleep schedules?
You have hit the nail on the head, because people talk about moving the bedtime earlier, but you can't make a child or anyone fall asleep, right? But you can guide their rise time. Hmm. So when people ask me how to get kids reset for school, I always say focus on the rise time, right? Move that a little bit earlier and earlier, 15 to 20 minutes every day until, you know, every few days, really, until you hit the time that they'll need to get up for the school year. And then right away, we always say this little phrase, sky before screens. So get them outside. Just 5 minutes will do it. Get them outside, having their eyes, you know, perceive the sun. And that really talks to the brain about the rise time. It teaches the brain, this is the rise time that you want. You're getting full spectrum sunlight. This is the time that I want you to start waking up. And then you're moving it back every few days until you reach that time that they need for the school year.
Does that seem more effective, Dr. Schneeberg, in having kids then go to bed earlier because they naturally are just going to be more tired? If they're getting up at 6 a.m., let's just say, to be out at the buses for 6:45 or 7 o'clock, I'm just making something up. Is that more of a natural way for them to be tired by the end of a school day, by the end of after school activities, homework, everything? Do they naturally tend to go to bed earlier then, or are you still looking at kids staying up way past when they should be going to bed?
Yes. Again, you have nailed it, because your body pays attention to how long you've been awake, right? And so if you've been awake longer because you got up 20 minutes earlier, then your body begins to adjust the bedtime to be earlier as well. It matches. So I always say the school time, the rise time drives the bus. Right. Mm. And then your body pays attention and makes you sleepier 20 minutes early. Also, it's just easier to control a child's rise time, the time they actually get up than the time they actually fall asleep.
Mm. And would you say we should also focus on rise times as adults?
Yes. A lot of people think that they have to catch up on sleep if they've gotten poor sleep during the week, let's say, right? And so they'll sleep in on the weekend. But some people have a rise time on the weekend that's 4 hours later than their rise time on the weekday, right? And that's very confusing for the body. The body wants to release hormones to wake you up and hormones to put you to sleep. And if your rise time varies that much, your body sort of doesn't know what to do, because every weekend, you're resetting it in a way. So we call it social jet lag. It's like flying somewhere without the benefit of actually flying somewhere, right?
Mm, yeah,
and
that
so
sounds terrible.
Yeah, it's not good for your body, doesn't like it. And so we have another phrase that we call school plus 2. And that means whatever time you have to get up for work or school, you wouldn't get up any more than 2 hours later than that time on the days off. And I'll say one more thing, your body already makes up for lost sleep in this way that lots of people don't know about. It changes the percentage of deep sleep and dream sleep, the two most important kinds of sleep, that you get after even one poor night of sleep. So it sort of steals away the lighter sleep you would get that night, that makeup night, and gives you more deep sleep and REM sleep until you're caught up. So you don't really need to sleep more than 2 hours later on the weekend, if you see what I mean.
I do. And again, we've got Dr. Schneeberg here, who is the Yale Medicine sleep psychologist and associate professor at Yale School of Medicine. And we're talking about the importance of sleep, especially as kids are getting back into routine, going to school. Maybe you, as the adults in the household, also wanting to kind of check your sleep and see if you could improve it. Maybe things changed for you. I know it did for us as well over the summertime hours. Now having our 8-year-old kind of get back on schedule before his first day of school on Thursday. Milford School's going back, a lot of other districts going back throughout this week and then early next. Let's talk about napping. So you had mentioned before, Dr. Schneeberg, that there are adults who will say, I need to catch up on sleep. I would think for, you know, when you're adjusting the rise times, you have to monitor that your kids are not napping, right? Because that kind of defeats the purpose of them then going to bed earlier. But what do you think about napping? How do you feel about banking hours in nap times, especially for adults?
Yes. I'm a big fan of napping for adults, as long as they do what I call optimal napping, which means it's after lunch and it's before dinner, right? And it's an hour or less. Anything else is a little confusing to your body. You know, there are people who get up in the morning and then they go back to sleep before lunch. That's not a great plan. Or they take a nap after dinner. Also not a great plan, because your body thinks, gosh, is this the beginning of my nighttime or is this a nap? What is this? And we even call the time after dinner the forbidden zone of napping, because it can push your bedtime later.
Right.
So, but as long as you're napping in the afternoon for a reasonable amount of time, that can be really refreshing. It can give you a lot more productive time in the day. There's not a thing wrong with it. Many cultures, as you know, build it into their day, a siesta or some sort of rest period. So I think they're great.
Okay, cool. I'm a hardcore napper. In fact, I've placed in many napping competitions. No, I haven't. But if there were any, I would crush it. Let me tell you. I am curious, though, is it possible, like, for freaks of nature to do well with 2 to 3 hour naps? I ask that because I do take those once in a while. And I feel great. I feel like I could run a marathon. I could clean my entire house top to bottom before dinner time. But people think I'm nuts. Like, I hear about power naps and how great those are. And hey, all you need is that 20, 30 minutes, maybe an hour. But I mean, Doc, let me tell you, if I'm getting a nap in, I actually cannot do a power nap. That makes me more tired. But if I could get a 2 to 3 somewhere in there hour nap in, man, I'm crushing it. But I feel like the reaction is always, well, you're insane. But I don't think I'm insane, Dr. Schneeberg. Tell me I'm not, please. That would really help with my confidence.
I can confirm that you are not insane, right? Your body doesn't lie. You don't do it very often. And when you do it, you feel great, right?
Thank you.
And a lot of people, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I just think whatever makes you feel productive and great is good. Now, if you were taking 2 or 3 hour naps every day, I would think, gosh, there's something wrong with your nighttime sleep. But it's a rare event.
You're like, wow, right? There's something wrong there.
something a little wrong there. There are people who do what's called bimodal sleep. A lot of teenagers, actually, who, and it's not a good plan. They go to bed at 2 in the morning and get up at school by 6. And they're so tired, of course, that when they come home from school, they might sleep again from, let's say, 3 o'clock to 7 o'clock. That's not a great plan.
Fair.
But what you described is great.
Oh, my gosh. Listen.
And you feel good.
I appreciate that, Dr. Schneeberg, because you just never know. And, you know, and a 3 a.m. alarm is not the norm, certainly, but I do. I love that little 2 hour break, if you will, before I pick up my kid from school. And then all of a sudden I feel like I'm doing like 2-a-days. Where, you know, I start
amazing.
All over again, right? But it works for whatever reason.
It works for you.
Yeah. I don't know. I always resonate with Sheryl Crow, who said, if it makes you happy, it can't be that bad. But now that you're solidifying it, it makes me feel even better. I was looking at Connecticut-specific data when it comes to sleep, and I found in a 2021 CDC report for Connecticut specifically, more than 78% of high school students reported insufficient sleep. And so we were talking about how do we get kids back on a good sleep schedule instead of focusing on maybe pulling back the bedtime? Like, hey, let's go to bed earlier. It is very hard to make somebody go to sleep. However, it's not as hard to make them wake up, and then they naturally kind of start to get more tired. They will then hopefully go to bed earlier. Just some of the many tips we are getting today from Dr. Linnell Schneeberg, who is the Yale Medicine sleep psychologist and associate professor at Yale School of Medicine. Can we talk a little bit, Doc, about the impact of sunlight exposure and breakfast timing?
Absolutely. So there are things that we call circadian cues, right? Clock setters. And the four of them that work really well are sunlight exposure, food, activity, and then social interaction, whatever you want to call that, right? So when you get your child up in the morning, if you do get them outside, that sky before screens idea, 5 minutes of sunlight exposure, that sunlight really talks to the brain and sets the new rise time. And then breakfast. Whenever you have breakfast, we now know that lots of our organs have clocks in them in a way, including our stomach. And so some breakfast comes down the hatch and our bodies know, wow, it must be morning because I'm having some breakfast. Then moving around, of course, any kind of activity, and then social interaction, talking to your kids, getting them engaged in things. All those things help them wake up.
What about, you know, you bring up the cell phone and it's interesting because I was thinking about going to bed at night. One of the biggest tips you'll always get is try to be screen free an hour or two before you go to bed because you don't want the brain to keep going and all that. What about in the morning? You know, so as far as I'll never forget when I was on my honeymoon cruise with my husband 10 years ago, there was like a couples, you know, dating show or whatever. And the number one answer for what is the first thing you grab in the morning, I'm thinking it's going to be something, but it was cell phone. Like the number one thing that somebody grabs first thing in the morning is their cell phone, not anything else but the cell phone. And I'm curious from your professional standpoint, the impact of, because you had mentioned before, like get the sunlight, not the screen light first. When should somebody ideally grab the tech, if you will, or how long should they delay that?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be long. Really, honestly, people are checking, making sure. Think about even with school, right? You're looking for any sort of school information that you might need, or is there a delay, especially in the winter? So it doesn't hurt to grab it, you know, within the first 15 minutes. That's not a big deal. But I love it if the first 5 or 10 minutes are really sort of a greeting the day, you know, going outside, taking a little bit of a stroll down to the mailbox, making a cup of something warm and comforting that you like. That's to me, a nicer way to start the day.
Okay. What do you think about remedies as well going to sleep? So full disclosure, Doc, I am not a melatonin or even a supplement user. I have tried different things. I feel like in the long term, it has not helped me at all with either keeping sleep throughout the night or not waking up feeling refreshed. So I'm more of a natural, if you will. So I stop, you know, with the screens. I try to kind of do a journal dump, you know, before I go to bed. Like I try to clear the brain. I heard about the chill pill. Have you heard about this thing? It's like an electrotherapy device you put in your hand for like 20 minutes and it's supposed to send like, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Again, I'm a fan of pretty old-fashioned, just like you said, I'm a fan of bedtime routines that cue sleep. If you do the same thing every night in the same order, your brain understands, oh, she wants to go to sleep, right? And so I love turning off the screens and then getting into bed, you know, doing your typical routine. People straighten up the kitchen, they do their face care, they get in their pajamas, and then getting in bed with a book or a Kindle on the night setting. Both of those are great. And then that becomes your cue for sleep. That's a great way to do it. And talking about kids here, once you're moving their bedtime, their rise times earlier, you can put them in bed earlier. That's not an issue, but you can let them read, right? You can let them read. And then when they're drowsy, they put the book away naturally. Or if they're not quite reset, you know, they haven't quite reset their clock, they'll just read a little bit longer that night. But screens, there's research showing that kids lose an average of an hour of night of sleep because of screens.
So, and I love what you said there, which is that don't be afraid to kind of put them in their bedrooms earlier, especially if they don't have televisions or tablets, things like that. How do you, I guess, help your school-aged kids become independent sleepers? I mean, we're not talking about toddlers here, but we're talking about like where kids can, you know, tell you, I'm ready to go to bed.
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing is that some parents, and I'm a parent of three, I totally get the the wonderfulness of the coziness of snuggling with your kids in the evening. But if you stay until your child is actually asleep, so if you sit in the room or lay in the bed until they're actually asleep, that becomes what's called a sleep onset association. You know, it sounds fancy, but it just means they can't really fall asleep without you there. And then since everybody wakes up at night 2 to 6 times, when they wake up, they feel that you're missing, if you see what I mean. You were there at bedtime. That's how they fell asleep. And then they sort of have to come and find you and bring you back to their room or get in your bed. And so I'm a big fan, again, of reading as the sleep onset association. Some people call it a sleep cue or a sleep trigger. So if you can have a great routine, tuck them in and leave them with a book and a book light, and that becomes the way they fall asleep, I think you're going to have a much more independent, secure sleeper.
And actually part of this, Doc, and I don't know if I'm right in saying this, but one of the things that my husband and I adopted a very long time ago before we had children was never bringing our work into the bedroom. So we never bring our laptops in. We never, if we're working from home, we never do our work calls in there, because it, for us as adults, it associated like stress in our, what should be kind of comfort, go to bed and, solace room. Does the same go for kids? The idea of like not eating in your room, not having, not bringing activity, if you will, into your bedroom, but making that kind of more of your relaxation space.
100%, right? Your bedroom should be a sanctuary from anything like that. And some parents, with a good intention, they talk about what's the best thing and worst thing that happened to you today. I think it's great to talk about the best thing. I don't think it's great to talk about the worst thing or worries. Mm. Some kids will bring up those worries when they're in the bed with their parent, and really they're kind of bringing them up to keep their parents in there longer, bring them, closer. That same thing we talked about just a minute ago. Can I help my parent? Can I do something that'll have my parents stick around longer so that I'm asleep before they leave, right? They won't tell you a thing in the car.
Yeah, exactly.
On the way home from school. Right. But they'll tell you all of that at night. And I don't think that's a great plan for the bedroom. Right. You wouldn't have a really serious conversation with your husband in bed at night. You'd save that for a different time of day. Mm. So those are the kind of things I talk with parents about. Have a time for that. Just maybe don't have it be in the bed, in the bedroom, right before they go to sleep.
That's a really good point. Such great advice and great timing for it, especially for kids going back to school, adults maybe resetting their clocks as well and trying to get on a better sleep schedule. And I thank you so much, Dr. Linnell Schneeberg, for all that you do. Yale Medicine sleep psychologist, associate professor at Yale School of Medicine. And thank you again for giving us the time here on WICC. We really appreciate it.